Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'll be moderating today's webinar on what you need to know about the California Consumer Privacy Act. While it is not yet finalized and not slated to go into effect until January 2020, companies that store consumer information from people in California need to start paying attention to this new law now. Consumers will be able to request all of their information for the preceding 12 months when the law becomes effective. And you may have the opportunity to impact the final requirements under this new privacy law. We're fortunate to have a panel of experts with us today to better help us understand this new law. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use, and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. June Coleman is a defense litigator with more than 20 years of experience. Her areas of emphasis include defense of consumer rights actions involving the FDCPA, TCPA, and FCRA. She has a deep understanding of the permissible debt collection conduct and how best to defend claims and minimize liability in the collection industry. She is the California Association of Collectors Attorney Chair and a member of the ACA MAP Attorney Steering Committee. She is also a director for the National Creditors Bar Association. Shelly Gensmer is the Vice President of Legal and Compliance for ERC. She's been with the company for the past 2 years. Shelly holds a CCCO designation from ACA International and has more than 13 years of litigation and collections experience ranging from first party, third party, legal to deceased collections. Shanae McKnight earned her Juris Doctorate from Florida Coastal, and currently serves as ERC's Compliance and Remediation Manager. As the company's state's expert, Shanae specializes in licensing, state's presence, laws, and regulations. She's been following the privacy law trend since the GDPR came to light and is well-versed in the CCPA as well. Lauren Valenzuela is Compliance Counsel at Performant Recovery, where she advises on compliance with consumer protection laws, government regulation, licensing, litigation defense, and transactional matters. Prior to joining Performant, she was General Counsel and Director of Compliance for Collection Technology Incorporated. The format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please hit the Q&A button on your Zoom webinar control panel and type it in. This event is an audio-only event. There is no video component or PowerPoint, so if you're not seeing anything on your screen, you're not missing anything. However, it is being recorded, and a recording will be made available in the coming days on AccountsRecovery.net. With that out of the way, the introduction out of the way, let's get to our main part of our discussion here. Shelly, I'm going to invite you in to say a few words about what the CCPA is.
Thank you, Mike, and good morning to everybody in the West Coast, and good afternoon to everybody else. Just want to jump in. There's a lot of stuff to cover today, so we're just going to kind of go in and hope we can get some really good discussion points covered today. As Mike said, be sure to submit questions, and we'll try our best to leave some wiggle room at the end so that we can get to everything. To start it off, what is the CCPA? The California Consumer Privacy Act was passed in June of 2018. The law stems from another in 1972, which established the right to privacy as among the inalienable rights of all people, further defining the right to privacy as being the ability of individuals to control the use, which includes things like the sale of their personal information. Since that time, other laws were created to safeguard these exact rights. Examples are the Online Privacy Protection Act, Privacy Rights for California Minors in the Digital World Act, as well as Shine the Light, etc. All of these laws aimed to give Californians the basics, the who, what, where, when, hows of how businesses handled their information. Europe has already started this new protection in its General Data Protection Regulation, also known as the GDPR, that became effective May 25th, 2018. California's CCPA mirrors much of Europe's law, and it is the first in the U.S. to tackle this very issue on that level. in the U.S. And of course, we anticipate that many states will follow suit. So with that, I'll pass the mic over to Ms. Shavane Knight. She'll kind of detail what the intentions of the law are. Shavane?
Hello, everyone. Can everyone hear me just fine?
Yep.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, wonderful. So as we know, privacy has really been a hot topic in the media lately. And with things such as Facebook and news coming out about Cambridge Analytica, since then, states and federal legislatures have been drafting privacy bills. However, none has come to fruition, as well as tightening cybersecurity legislation due to big company data breaches such as Equifax. Well, since then, in fall of 2017, Californians submitted a ballot initiative that was targeted for the November 2018 election that just passed. That initiative deviated dramatically from traditional privacy laws. Therefore, it was not favorable amongst businesses. However, it gained more than 600,000 California signatures on the petition. So this created a sort of rushed response from the California legislature. That legislative effort was signed into law June 28th, enacting what we now know as the California Consumer Privacy Act, aka CCPA, which legislators was looking to enact in order to have the ballot initiative that I just discussed withdrawn. It was sort of a last minute maneuver to head off the privacy initiative from the November ballot. So yes, because of this rush initiative, changes are expected to be addressed in different concerns that businesses have. And since then, in September, Senate Bill 1121 was also signed into law, which also made amendments to the CCPA. It clarified the private right of action portion in the law as applying to only data breach liability, which I'm sure perhaps June will discuss in her enforcement portion. And it also clarified the scope of exemptions to entities governed by GLBA. And it provided businesses with a 30-day notice opportunity to cure. So these concerns have somewhat been addressed since the implementation of the CCPA in June with that September law going into effect, or that law going into effect in September. And however, all of business concerns have not been addressed. There are other concerns such as the broad definition of personal information and the excessive penalties that companies would perhaps have to face in the event of a data breach. All in all, the bill is attempting to allow data subjects to achieve three things, basically ownership, control, and security. It will allow data subjects the right to know what personal information is being collected, sold, disclosed, and to whom, the right to say no to a sale, and also it will allow for penalties for a business that suffers from a breach of security. And with that, that is the background and everything in regards to what the bill is trying to address.
Got it. Thank you very much, Shavane. Shelley, let me come back to you and let me ask how this bill or law stacks up against other existing privacy laws.
I don't want to dive too much into it because I think we're going to kind of cover some of that in the rest of the discussion. But if you look at the GDPR, that's the one that it seems to be taking the biggest example from, basically. I mean, when technology got bigger, badder, and even smarter, the current privacy laws, then we're not sufficient. You know, with basically just not holding up to what people are now able to do as far as selling consumer information and, you know, I mean, silly things like the black web and how you end up with like a million different spam emails, and it just got to be too much. So as far as it's stacking up, I think this is definitely taking it to the very next level, just trying desperately to keep up with current technology. And unfortunately, that's just going to keep on getting bigger and badder, and we're just going to have to keep on climbing. So I think this is a good reaction to the need. I think that obviously needs some very real definition and finessing, especially as it impacts our industry, which I don't think that this law considered the debt collection industry at all when they began to draft it. You know, you've got the Googles of the world that are fighting back. And so, you know, the impact to our industry wasn't considered, I don't think. I think it was kind of swept under the rug. So it's important that we get on these webinars and we discuss these things and try to get as much exposure from our industry and as many comments and concerns sent in to the rulemakers while we can, so that we can make sure this doesn't become a, you know, company destroyer for us, so to speak.
Definitely agree that I don't think anybody on this call wants it to be a company destroyer. So
that's a very strong term, but you know what I mean.
it definitely puts an image in everybody's head. Lauren wanted to ask you, are there certain types of categories that this law is going to apply to?
Hey guys, this is Lauren. I could jump in and answer that. So the CCPA does not apply to some categories that were mentioned earlier, such as information governed by HIPAA, the Gramm-Leach-Bailey Act, GLBA, and also the selling of information under the Fair Credit Reporting Act. Something additional to think about with this is that I think it's really important to kind of start at the top, and let's dive in a little bit and kind of look at the layers of this law. So the CCPA applies to California consumers and businesses, even if they're outside of California, that collect personal information about California consumers. So there's a lot to unpack there. So let's start really quickly with consumer. It defines it as a natural person who resides in California. It defines businesses, and this is where I think a lot of us really need to look at how it defines businesses, as, you know, a sole proprietor, partnership, limited liability company, corporation, or other legal entity that is organized for profit or financial benefit of its shareholders or owners, that collects consumers' personal information, that does business in the state of California, and satisfies one or more three thresholds. So the first one is a business that has annual gross revenues in excess of $25 million. The second one is whether alone or in combination, a business that annually buys, receives for business commercial purposes, sells or shares for commercial purposes, alone or in combination, the personal information of 50,000 or more consumers, households, or devices. So take note of that in terms of how it breaks it down, 50,000 consumers or households or devices. So it's pretty broad. And the third one, threshold that it will look at to see if it's a business that qualifies under CCPA, is a business that derives 50% or more of its annual revenues from selling consumers' personal information. So let's look at what is personal information under CCPA.
Hey, Lauren.
Yep.
Lauren, this is June, and so I just wanted to make sure I understood that. CCPA is looking about whether they fall within the scope of this new CCPA. If they don't make over $25 million a year, then that takes them out of that avenue to this law. And the other one that I thought was probably pertinent was, you know, the purchase of 50,000 information about 50,000 people or devices or households. Mm-hmm. So would you advise people that one of the ways they can see if they fall within this law is to determine whether or not they do 50,000 skip traces a year?
You know, I think that's a great question, and I'm still wrapping my head around that in terms of, okay, as a collection agency, I don't think that we should only be looking at, oh, do we have 50,000 accounts with addresses in California? I think we have to go deeper than that, because if you look at the essence of what it's trying to do, it's trying to capture as many California residents as it can. And so you bring up a good point in the sense of, hey, if you are collecting data from California residents or households or whatever, you know, you might need to look at your skip tracing attempts with people in California, which you know, is a different way to think about it, instead of thinking about it as in terms of an account. Do you know what I mean? So,
So if an agency uses three different skip trace tools, mm-hmm. on an individual, and perhaps does that two or three times over a year, that would be like nine times per account. And so it, not necessarily looking at the number of California accounts you have even, but recognizing that it could be the number of times you skip trace, and skip trace could be looking on the internet or buying a credit bureau report or something along those lines. Would that be a fair kind of concern to really calculate that?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that's a valid point. And like I said, I think that, you know, we have to remember the intent of this law, and it's written in a way to capture as much protection of California residents as possible. So I think that's a really, you know, serious thing that we need to look at. And I think that's a really good point, Jen. Absolutely. Kind of changing gears a little bit, along those same lines, it defines personal information very broadly as well. It's trying to cast a wide net here, and it essentially says, hey, any information that identifies, relates to, describes, is capable of being associated with, or could possibly be linked directly or indirectly with a particular consumer or household. So personal information is really broad here, and it includes any information if it identifies, relates to, describes, is being capable of, associated with, or could be possibly linked directly or indirectly with a particular consumer or household. And some examples that the statute provides for are, you know, your real name, alias, address, unique personal identifier, online identifier, IP address, email, social security number, driver's license, and there are other characteristics that are protected under California or federal law, commercial information, personal property, personal or products and services purchased, obtained, search history, browsing history, website visits, so on and so forth. So it is really broad. One thing to note, though, personal information does not include publicly available information, which is information lawfully made available from state, federal, or local government records. And it doesn't include information, consumer information that is de-identified or aggregated consumer information. So those are two things to keep in mind. And before we go further, we should explore some types of personal information and data excluded from the CCPA. And we touched on this a little earlier. So once again, it excludes data governed by HIPAA, GLBA, and information sold under FCRA if that information is used to generate a consumer report. Now, something else to keep in mind here, the CCPA also does not apply if every aspect of a commercial activity, that is collecting or selling personal information, takes place wholly outside of California. And that means businesses collected that information while the consumer was outside of California, not doing business in California, no part of the sale of the consumer's personal information occurred in California, you know, you might not be subject to the CCPA. However, it has pretty broad tentacles, so be very cautious with how you look at your activities if you're looking at that exception of the CCPA. Changing gears a little, I don't know if anyone, I'll take a pause and add, ask if anyone wants to add anything.
Well, I have, there've been a couple of questions that have come in, related to, GLBA. And when you, when you're talking about how the law or information covered under GLBA might not apply, under this new CCPA law. There have been a couple of questions that have come in. Would that totally exempt debt collectors because all of our info falls under GLBA? And that being, is that something you can expand upon?
Sure. So this is one myself that I was really trying to say, hey, as a collection agency, we are covered under GLBA. Do we fall under this exception? And I think this still requires further analysis and consideration. And I honestly don't have the answer, because when you look at what GLBA, what type of non-public personal information that the GLBA protects, it looks at financial information. So I'm still kind of squaring my head on, okay, how does that compare to other types of information that we collect as an agency, whether that's, website visits or as part of your search engine optimization or SEO, whether that's, hey, if you collect information about third parties during your skip tracing activities, I don't know if that would be covered under GLBA. So I don't know the answer to that, but I do think that we need to think outside of the box when we look at this law and really think about what kind of data we're collecting and how we're collecting it, because the CCPA is written so broadly and it's new and it's unprecedented. I don't think that we've really stopped and sat and thought, okay, let's categorize the types of data we're actually collecting in our everyday activities. I don't think all of it will be protected under GLBA. That's my opinion, but that's still formulating. Does anyone else have any thoughts about that, though?
This is June, and I do, because to begin with, the CCPA, the California Consumer Privacy Act, actually states that it doesn't apply to personal information collected, processed, sold, or disclosed pursuant to the Federal Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act and implementing regulations if it is in conflict with that law. And that's quite common when you have a state law versus a federal law. The federal law is probably going to win out, but the federal laws oftentimes say, but the states can do their own as long as they're not really interfering. And so here I see that same thing, and I wonder if that means that as long as Gramm-Leach-Bliley doesn't say if a consumer asks for information, you don't have to provide it, it seems to me that we probably need to comply.
Yeah, I would say so. I think we really need to think about what types of information we collect. I mean, if as an agency, for example, and you are skip tracing and talking to third parties that are in California, okay, well, you just collected someone's third party's phone number, possibly their address, their name. That arguably is information that falls under personal information under CCPA, but wouldn't necessarily be protected, I don't think, under Gramm-Leach-Bliley, because it doesn't pertain to the consumer that we're having the relationship or transaction with. So does that make sense? I think we need to really think how we collect data and who we collect it from, and as we look at CCPA.
Lauren, I'm just quickly reviewing GLBA, and that talks about how people should respond, how companies should respond to consumers' requests for information about, you know, how you're gathering information and who you're sharing information with. So it would appear to me, on a brief overview, that much of this is not going to be in conflict with GLBA. And let me just stress that one of the things that's happening here is, as Shelley mentioned, and the law was enacted in a rush, and it is completely expected that this law will be revised again. I think it's already been amended once, that it will be amended to get out all the kinks. So to the, to the extent that we're concerned about how this exception, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley exception, works and what Gramm-Leach-Bliley requires, that may be something that comes out with, the amendments and is fleshed out more. So I think you're going to hear us talk about how we anticipate this could be, addressed given the language that now exists, but recognize that, it's not set in stone yet.
Yeah, that's a great point. I noticed another participant kind of asked a little bit more about the FCRA exemption and any info that we collect from credit bureaus, would that be exempt? So if you actually look at how the exemption is written, it says for information that is sold under FCRA pursuant, to generate a consumer report. I read that, that doesn't cover information that is furnished under the FCRA, only information, for example, maybe we buy a consumer report as part of our skip tracing as an agency. But what about when we furnish information to a CRA? To me, how the exemption is written for FCRA does not encompass that activity. So there are a lot of unknowns with this law, and as you really sit down and try to understand how you would adapt compliance, it raises a lot of questions like the ones we're talking about now. And I think it really stresses the importance, as Shelley was saying earlier, for us to participate as an industry and take advantage of the Attorney General's upcoming public forums to get our questions out there and get our, ask for support in these areas as we interpret and try to comply the best we can with this law.
Also, I just wanted to jump in really quickly as Lauren was going back a little bit, as Lauren was discussing the definition of consumer and how broad that definition is. I would also like to point out, in the CCPA, it discusses the consumer as a natural person who is a resident of California. And the definition of residence in California, it includes any natural person enjoying the benefit and protection of California laws. So that can include for temporary purposes. So any person who's a domiciliary of California will also seem to fall under that scope. In a definition, and so I would just stress as well to not only to see if you fall within the scope of the law, looking for just California accounts. Also, look to there will be people who fall within this law that are affected, who are domiciliaries, not just, as we know, residents to live in the state, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure does. Thank you for the clarification, Sheree. Lauren, wanted to come back to you, and we've kind of sort of outlined, what the law is and who it applies to. maybe you could spend a minute or two going into what's required under the law.
Sure. Well, so once, you know, once a business is subject to the CCPA, many requirements kick in based on the rights that the California consumers have. But, you know, I think it's important to look at the rights. And the way that I wrap my head around these is that CCPA creates about four buckets of rights for consumers. And there are many nuances to these rights, and we're only going to go over them at a high level on this webinar. So I really encourage everyone to review them in detail, you know, with qualified counsel after this webinar. But, you know, let's jump right into it. The first bucket of rights includes the consumer's right to know what personal information a business has about them and where, by category, that personal information came from or was sent to. So there's, I would say that's like the first bucket. And within there's also a right to a consumer's right to data portability and things like that. The second bucket is a consumer's right to delete personal information that a business collected from them. So that's the second bucket. The third, I would say, is the consumer's right to opt out of the sale of personal information about them. And another bucket is their consumer's right to receive equal service and pricing from a business, even if they exercise their rights under the act. So there's a lot to unpack there as well. And like I said, many nuances, but, you know, for the sake of making this digestible, I'll just give you some key takeaways of things to think about as we all prepare for compliance with this law. So businesses subject to the CCPA will have to disclose on its online privacy policy and our website a description of the consumer's rights. So that's going to be, you know, the right to request personal information, right to delete personal information, right to opt out, so on and so forth. And provide one or more designated methods for consumers to submit their requests. The disclosures must also include a list of the categories of personal information it has collected about consumers in the preceding 12 months. Now, pay attention to this. This means that there is effectively a 12-month look-back period under CCPA. So although CCPA does not go into effect until January 1st, 2020, it was and is operative as of January 1st, 2019. So this means that come January 1st, 2020, businesses need to be prepared to give these disclosures and process incoming requests from consumers and really be able to provide data it collected from the preceding 12 months, meaning data being collected as of today on today's webinar. So really, really pay attention to that 12-month look back period. I think myself included, earlier on, I was like, oh, there's time, that doesn't go into, you know, effect until next year. However, this is a little, I feel like, unknown or understated requirement of CCPA that we should all pay attention to. Kind of changing gears a little bit, the statute further specifies, you know, that a business policies and online disclosures must be updated at least once every 12 months. And as I mentioned, the business must provide consumers with at least two methods for submitting requests. And at a minimum, it says, hey, you have to give consumers a toll-free number. And if you have a website, you have to provide a website address for them to submit requests. So to me, in a way, this could imply that we might be able, be required to accept requests via some kind of online form on our website, possibly. I don't know. So businesses really need to look at the infrastructure that's going to be required to accept and respond to incoming requests, you know, which really means that we need to be looking at our training, our scripts, our policies, our procedures to see what adjustments we need to make to support compliance with this. It's really just around the corner. Now, you may be thinking, how can I authenticate a request is really from a consumer? And the CCPA says a request only needs to be processed if it is from a verifiable, quote unquote, verifiable consumer request. So you might be thinking, well, what the heck is that? The guidance the CCPA gives us to identify the consumer is to compare what the consumer provides in their request to quote unquote, any personal information previously collected by the business about the consumer. So to me, it's kind of unclear, and I hope this is something that the Attorney General clarifies and provides further guidance on in the rules. But as I currently, as I read this in its current form, to me, this says, we can ask a consumer to verify their identity using any pieces of information that we have before we respond to their request. But I would say let's keep our eye on that and see if any more guidance is provided. Another concern that you might have that I know came up in discussions with others in the industry is the concern of the amount of influx of requests that CCPA may generate, similar to the credit repair organization disputes. So, you know, the protections against this that the CCPA built in is a requirement that requests only be processed that are verifiable consumer requests. And it also states that a business is not obligated to provide information to the same consumer more than once in a 12-month period. And then the Act further states that if a request from a consumer are quote-unquote manifestly unfounded or excessive, then a business can either charge a fee for responding or not respond. However, the onus, the burden is on the business to demonstrate that the request, the multiple requests were manifestly unfounded and excessive. Let's change gears a little bit. I want us to touch on just a few more things about this law. And let's look at the consumer's right to request deletion of their information. So I am sure consumers would love to tell any debt collector to delete their information. However, the CCPA provides 9 exemptions to this right. So a business does not need to comply with the request to delete the consumer's personal information if it's needed to do specific things, such as complete the transaction for which the personal information was collected, provide a good or service requested by the consumer, or that is reasonably anticipated within the context of a business's ongoing business relationship with the consumer, or otherwise perform a contract between the business and the consumer. You don't need it to delete information if it's needed to detect security incidents. You don't need to delete, and if it's if you need it to enable if the data is solely for internal uses that are reasonably aligned with the expectation of the consumer based on the consumer's relationship with the business, or if you need it to comply with a legal obligation, or otherwise the use of the consumer's personal information internally is a lawful manner that is compatible. So those are some of the exceptions which I believe will apply to most of the work that we do here, at least for myself as the collection agency. And in the interest of time, we didn't touch too much on a consumer's right to opt out of a sale of their information, but do know that a business that does sell information must provide in a readily accessible and clear and conspicuous form an option for a consumer to opt out of the sale of their information. And I would just like to note, I think this is going to be really interesting for those consumer products on the market, such as call blocking apps that collect and sell consumers' information to consumer attorneys, for example, as leads. I'm really curious to see how that might be impacted. And I really wish we had more time to really dissect each of these rights more. There's lots of nuances, but we don't. So with that said, I don't know if we want to look at any questions that have been asked or if we want to kind of transition into enforcement over the act.
I'm going to save some of the questions for the end. I want to get to the enforcement section, but thank you very much for the comprehensiveness of your remarks, Lauren. June, you know, people are looking at this thinking, I'm a small company. I'm not based in California. What's the worst that can happen to me? So what kind of enforcement and oversight mechanisms are built into this law?
So I always like to be the person that delivers the what's the worst that can happen to me information. So there are a couple of interesting things about this. To begin with, there is a private right of action, which means that you can't be sued by consumers. But in order for them to get statutory damages, they have to provide a 30-day notice and an opportunity to cure. So they have to give you a notice within 30 days of filing the lawsuit, and then you have 30 days to cure. So what does that mean? Cure means that you tell them that you have fixed what they claim is wrong and that you won't do it again. So if no cure is possible, or if you did not cure, you did not send the letter, or you violate again, then a consumer can go with a private lawsuit. The interesting dynamics about this is, I'll get into the interesting dynamics in just one second. So consumer sues you, then gives you a notice, then you respond back and say, hey, I fixed it and I won't do it again. The consumer should dismiss their lawsuit. Going to complain that you haven't actually fixed anything, or that their violation is not curable. They've already been injured. So it'll be interesting to see how that all develops.
Okay, cool. Some slightly scary stuff there.
Well, if I may add to that quickly.
Sure.
That private right of action, I would just like to point out, is a limited private right of action. So for consumers whose non-encrypted or non-redacted personal information is subject to unauthorized access. So say you have a data breach or data incident within your company, then that consumers will be allowed to come for you in a private right of action.
Okay, thank you for that. Just in case anyone's wondering, I think June had some technical difficulty and dropped the call. She didn't just sort of stop speaking mid-sentence there. So I'm sure she'll probably hopefully call back and we'll get to that. In the meantime, there's some questions that have come in. Let's start to tackle those. And anybody, Shave, Shelly, Lauren, feel free to jump in. A question.
Hey, Mike, I'm sorry.
Yep. That's okay.
I went mute to cough for a moment and all hell broke loose. So. Let me get back to what I was talking about.
Nice, right?
Yes. So this curative letter is not new to us, because we have it in California in the Rosenthal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act and under the Fair Debt Buying Practices Act. Plaintiffs claim that the letter can't cure the violation. There's already been harm done. So we'll see how that develops. If they get no curative letter, or they get a curative letter and then you do the same thing again, they don't have to dismiss their lawsuit. At that point in time, they also need to send the AG a notice within 30 days of filing and tell the AG that they're bringing this lawsuit. The AG has three options. The AG can respond and say, wow, this sounds like a really horrible thing. I'm going to take over. But if the AG does not proceed, if the AG says they're going to take over, then theoretically you need to dismiss. Or if the AG says they're going to take over and they're going to file their own lawsuit, but they don't proceed in 6 months, then the consumer can prosecute. So this creates this weird dynamic where there's a lawsuit filed and answers due in 30 days, and the curative letter is going out, and the notice to the AG is going out. And if the curative letter comes back, then they have to dismiss. But all of that doesn't happen in 30 days, so theoretically you have to respond. It's just procedurally, I think there are some hiccups, and I hope that this is something that gets fixed. In addition to the AG's response that they're going to handle this lawsuit, then the AG could also step in and say, there's no claim here. you must dismiss. And then the consumer would have to dismiss. Or the AG does nothing for 30 days, and then the consumer can proceed. So again, I don't really know how this falls out with the civil procedure rules for litigation, but we're gonna see. Now, this would create a private action for breach of data, and also for violating your obligations under the statute, which is the way I took was you failed to respond for a request for information with the information, or you failed to delete information when you should have, or you failed to put the notice on your website. So all of that, all of those types of claims would fall under this statute. There are statutory damages of $100 to $750 per incident, unless actual damages are greater. The way they determine $100 to $750 is on a sliding scale basis based on the nature and seriousness of the misconduct, the number of violations, the persistence of the misconduct, the length of time over which the misconduct occurred, the willfulness of the defendant's misconduct, and the defendant's assets, liabilities, and net worth. No one will really ever litigate this issue, probably, because $100 to $750 is not a money that's worth litigating, unless those number of incidents are really high, which is possible. The other way that you could have a private right of action, I think that I missed, was that if you violate again, so there's no notice required for a second violation, it's not clear after how much time. So that's another issue that we'll kind of flesh out. On the flip side, and in addition to statutory damages, potential actual damages, they can also collect attorney's fees and costs, obviously. On the flip side, the AG could prosecute an action. And if the AG prosecutes the action, it's $7,500 per violation. But they cite to Business and Professions Code section 17206 in section 1798.155, which covers AG actions. 17206 is under the Unfair Business Practices Act. And if you violate this law, you would also violate the Unfair Business Practices Act. And that is a $2,500 penalty. So it's not clear to me whether there would be a total of a $10,000 penalty per violation or $7,500 or not. And then a portion of the recovery gets, if the AG does an action, recovers, portions go to different things. 20% would go to the Consumer Privacy Fund. And so the last thing I'll talk about on suits before Mike has questions is statute of limitations. There's no specific statute of limitations set forth in the California Consumer Privacy Act. So we believe it would fall under the 2-year statute of limitations for causes of action causing personal injury, right to privacy actions. If an AG were to do it, there's a unfair competition law, unfair business practice law cases that talk about there being a 1-year statute of limitations for penalties imposed by the government. The Unfair Competition Law or Unfair Business Practices Act has a 4-year statute of limitations. But there are cases going both ways between the 1-year and the 4-year. So not real clear about the AG action, statute of limitations. And Mike, do we have any questions?
Yep. But before we get into those, I had one question just sort of for kind of sort of to kind of bring everything home. Shelly, I'm curious if you could provide any insight. If people listening on this call, still a lot in the air, a lot up in the air, still a lot to be decided, still a lot of confusion as to how this is all going to play out. But I need to be ready, you know, in case someone comes to me on January 1st, 2020 and asks me for all this information. So if I'm a collection agency, what advice would you give to, you know, to these people to, you know, to start preparing for this law now?
Well, that's a very, very broad answer. And, you know, I'm not an attorney and I'm certainly not your attorney. So just for the sake of throwing that out there,
of course,
you know, don't want it to be taken as legal advice, of course. I think certainly look at the categories of data that your company collects and see what it falls under as far as it and bounce it back against the CCPA as it's currently written. Prepare yourselves to be able to just access that information and you know, look also, of course, at your privacy policies and make sure that you've got some of those different things bumped up against it. Of course, set a tickler for yourself that it has to be updated every 12 months so you don't miss those steps. But obviously, just look at your business practice and, you know, see if it looks like or even smells like it could possibly be covered. I realize how broad and silly and over, like that umbrella is far too huge to really kind of zone in on. But I would just assume, I mean, I think the most conservative approach is the best approach. If you have a website that your consumers can use and access in order to self-service their accounts or submit questions, concerns, cease calls, et cetera, you know, you've got cookies, you've got all kinds of means that your consumers' information is being collected, including IP addresses. I mean, my gosh, if you read the actual statute, and it literally, I don't remember which section it is, it includes olfactory senses. Like, it could not have missed a single thing. So just start to prepare your policies and procedures to reflect that, to put the protections in place now. Obviously, seek some legal assistance if you feel like you have additional questions and concerns. But, you know, while we're still trying to get these things in place and get some better definition around it, I really encourage everybody on this call and their individual companies to prepare a statement, you know, individual comments that include where your concerns are, how this affects your business. And, you know, in speaking with the ACA, who I will compile all these things and send them individually for us, if you submit them, they're going to create a spot on their website that you can submit these things. You can also view other people's statements. But the reason why this is important is, as I stated before, you know, you've got the big hitters, the Googles of the world that like really overshadow the debt collection agencies. So if we mm-hmm. can have a more quantitative impact right out of the gates, that is huge. We want our industry not to get swept under the rug. So come up with your questions, express your concerns, submit a statement, and we've got to just kind of combine forces. So let ACA have those. And then at the back end of it, ACA will do their own, you know, singular, more nationally recognized act, you know, towards the end of it, based on what they've been able to see changed or not changed. I mean, those are my best pointers for you guys for now.
It's a good start. We've only got a couple of minutes left, and there's some questions that have come in, so let's see if we can rapid fire get through these as quickly as possible. Could anyone shed some light on the phrase, determines the purpose and means of processing within the definition of business under the Act, and whether control of the processing information determines applicability?
Okay. I don't believe, I'm looking at the act right now, I don't believe that is defined. They're asking business purpose, determines the purpose and meaning of processing. That processing definition is not defined. However, business purpose is, and that's going to be relevant when we're exchanging data for a business purpose, and I can shed some light on that. So the Act defines business purpose means the personal information for the business or service provider's operational purposes. Or other notified purposes, provided that the use of the personal information shall be reasonably necessary and proportionate to achieve the operational purpose for which the personal information was collected or processed. And then it provides some examples of business purposes, such as auditing related to a current interaction with the consumer, detecting security incidents, debugging to identify and repair errors, performing services. This is interesting. This will probably cover a lot of our relationships with vendors and in the data exchange we do with them. And it provides performing services on behalf of the business or service provider, including maintaining or servicing accounts, providing customer service, processing or fulfilling orders and transactions, verifying customer information, processing payments, providing financing, advertising, marketing services, and things like that. So I hope that sheds a little bit of light. And I would also add one thing that came to mind for me is I feel like we all really need to look at our contracts with our clients and with vendors, because the Act is very specific that if you have certain things in there that are defined in your contractual relationships, you may be able to protect that data exchange, that data sharing that you're doing with vendors and clients. It might fall under, the business purpose. So one thing I encourage everybody to do is look at the Act, look at their contracts, see what types of adjustments may need to be made. There are some specific things in there, such as, hey, you need to have certain things in contracts in order for it to fall under a permitted business purpose and so on and so forth.
Hey, Mike, just an additional thing. This is June. 1798.140 subsection Q defines processing means operations or set of operations that are performed on personal data or on sets of personal data. By way of an example, I would say that credit reporting agencies process their the personal data to come up with a credit report score. So processing could be a lot of different things, but I think they're really trying to, get to that conduct where people are using personal data to take action. I think Facebook uses personal data to feed ads to you. That's what I really think processing means on this statute.
Okay. Next question, and we'll try and get to one or two more here before we have to go because we're already over an hour. Can you briefly go over what type of consumer information can be requested by a consumer for the preceding 12 months?
Hey guys, this is Lauren. I can do that really quickly. So if you get a request, you will have to disclose the categories of personal information that you've collected, the categories of information that you may be sold or disclosed to third parties to whom the personal information was shared with. And you also have to disclose the purpose of that disclosure as well. So I believe you'll have to do it for each type of data that you have. So the law goes into a pretty enumerated list of the types of things you'll have to disclose, and I encourage everyone to take a look at that to make a list. It's pretty long.
Got it. I think we have time for one last question. I'm going to try and see if I can make it one that isn't too in depth. You discussed criteria that would need to be met for the CCPA to apply. Does the business need to meet all 3 points for it to apply to them, or if one applies, the business subject to the law?
So you have to just meet one of the thresholds. So if you are a business that is a for-profit business, meaning you're not a nonprofit, and you satisfy one or more of the thresholds, you will be subject to the CCPA.
Got it.
Excellent. And Mike, well, I know that you're trying to wrap this up.
That's okay.
But I wanted to mention that, the AG is responsible for rulemaking, which could clarify things as the legislature is looking at enacting and amending aspects so that it clarifies things. In support of its rulemaking, the AG is having rulemaking workshops through February. They're found at the AG's website, www.oag.ca.gov. My apologies, /privacy/CCPA. And they're throughout the state. AG is going to be accepting comments. There's no deadline about when the cutoff will be for those comments, but we anticipate it to be early to mid-February, easily could extend to March. Once those comments and once the workshops are completed and the comments are gathered, the AG will put together some proposed rules. Those proposed rules will then be put out for comment. There's normally, at least a 60-day period for comment. Once those comments that come back in, then they tinker with the rules and they issue the rules with, how they were impacted by the comments. The process is long and tedious. And, if the act gets amended, that may put some, kinks in the process. So I would be surprised if they had rules out by the beginning of 2020.
Well, I guess this is just the beginning of what I'm sure will be a long trek toward this law going into effect and how everybody, especially those of us in the arm industry, are going to comply with it. So I'm sure we'll be talking about this a lot during the course of 2019 and into 2020. But before I let everybody go, I want to thank June, Lauren, and Cheve, and a special thanks to Shelly for coming to me with this idea for this webinar. Thank you. Thanks to all of you for taking your time to try and help us better understand this important law. This webinar would definitely not have been possible without your participation. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions and signed up. A recording of this event will be posted to Accounts Recovery in the next coming days. Please stay tuned to AccountsRecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Panelists, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
And thank you for inviting us.
No problem. Have a great day, everybody, and a great weekend. And we'll talk to you soon. Take care.